This piece was brought to you by the International Culinary Center, culinarycenter.com, heritageradionetwork.org.
Pleasure.
Our gift to you this holiday season is a marvelous mashup of just a few of our favorite things, our most inspiring podcasts. We're bundling up the best moments from Evolutionaries, which features the stories behind the movers, shakers, and makers in food today. This segment, Ladies in the House, focuses on three women behind the kitchens of some of the nation's most exciting restaurants: Mary Sue Milliken, Lydia Bostianich, and Lydia Shire. First up is Mary Sue Milliken, a food pioneer who helped define California cuisine with her restaurants City Restaurant, Border Grill, and Ciudad. Take a listen and hear how this Michigan transplant got her culinary groove in the City of Angels.
Opening with a tandoori, a wood-burning grill, two woks and 12 burners, a bunch of cooks that we hadn't had time to train. It was just me and Susan who knew the recipes, and we knew them inside and out, but we just couldn't spread ourselves far enough to make that opening, you know, bearable. But I think, you know, it really set me up to never do that again, believe me.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org proudly presents Evolutionaries, Mary Sue Milliken. Mary Sue Milliken is often credited with helping define Los Angeles's culinary landscape. Along with her partner Susan Feniger, she opened City Restaurant, Border Grill, and Ciudad, all critically acclaimed restaurants in the Los Angeles area. She's published 5 cookbooks and is a seasoned TV personality. Mary Sue was a food star before there were many. She's never been afraid to take risks, and her journey begins in St. Clair, Michigan.
You know, I started my journey in food when I was really young. I fell in love with cooking when I was, I think, in about 6th grade through a crazy recipe I found in one of my mother's magazines that I got up at 4 in the morning to make, and it turned out it was puff pastry, or Danish dough, actually, with a yeasted dough. And when, you know, when it rose in the oven and became that flaky pastry, I was just completely mesmerized and hooked because I was so baffled by the recipe. Like, you roll out the dough and you roll out the butter to a certain 17 inches by 12 inches, and then you fold and roll and fold and roll. And I thought, well, what is all this rigmarole going to accomplish anyway? And then when I saw the final product, I was just, you know, completely hooked. And I started, you know, looking at food much more seriously after I was about 16 and I met a professional chef who was a friend of my sister's. And it was just in one evening's dinner party that I decided I would not go to college but go to chef school instead. And I hurried off to move to Chicago from Lansing, Michigan, and try to get into chef school when I was 17. I could see that my mom's face sort of fell when I told her I wanted to go to chef school. It was sort of like saying, you know, I'm going to go and be an auto mechanic. You know, nobody could really get behind that. It wasn't very exciting. There weren't any celebrity chefs. There weren't any role models for women in cooking in 1976. You know, Julia Child was on TV, but she didn't own restaurants, and it was still, you know, early on before Alice Waters was getting to be known. There were a couple of French women chefs in Paris, and I think the vibe at home was, you know, she'll go do that for a year, and she'll realize that that's way too hard, and then we'll get her into college or something. But, of course, that didn't happen. I fell in love with everything about the kitchen, everything about the camaraderie of the, you know, food community and the way restaurants worked. And, you know, I went just deeper and deeper. I never felt daunted by it.
Mary Sue left home at 17 to attend Washburn Culinary Institute in Chicago and follow her dreams. It was there where she'd get her feet wet and eventually meet Susan Feniger, her culinary partner.
I've always loved Chicago. The city was so good to me. I mean, I was a 17-year-old, kind of fresh-faced young girl from Michigan, and I was going to chef school on the south side at 31st and Kedzie, and in a pretty rough neighborhood even. But I got lots of support from my jobs and from the people at school. I was, you know, kind of unusual. There were two women in a class of 100 students in the chef department, and it was a two-year program every day of the year except for Thanksgiving and Christmas Day. And the weekends we didn't work, but we were in school 5 days a week for 2 years straight. And at night I worked in restaurants. So although I didn't have a lot of time to explore the city, I did always feel like Chicago was very welcoming and supportive. And I got a scholarship actually for my second year of chef school, which at the time, it was a trade tech school on the south side of Chicago called Washburn Trade School. And at the time, tuition was $1,500 a year. And it was such a relief when I got a full scholarship for the second year of trade school.
Mary Sue's relationship with Susan Feniger would help define her career. Mary Sue and Susan were the first women ever to receive the California Restaurant Writers' prestigious Chef of the Year Award.
When I graduated, I didn't at all feel like I was really ready for much more than a good line cook job. And I had my sights set on a restaurant called Le Perroquet, which was owned by a Yugoslavian gentleman, and it was one of the top two or three French restaurants in the city at the time, 1978. The director of Washburn Trade School was a Yugoslav, and I went to him and I said, do you think you could get me an interview with Jovan Trbojevic, because that's really the only restaurant I want to work in. It's really the best place to eat in the city, and I want to learn how to make that food. And he got me an interview, and I went in and had a great chat with Jovan, but he just kind of laughed and said, I couldn't hire you to work in the kitchen because you'd cause havoc back there. You know, no one would be able to concentrate. They'd be looking at you, and, you know, you're a pretty girl, and this would be just too much of a problem for me, so I can't really offer you a job. But, you know, maybe you'd like to work as a hat check girl in the restaurant. I was crushed. I cried all the way home in the car, and I just decided I'm not going to take no for an answer. I started a letter campaign, and I started calling him on the phone once a week, sending a letter twice a week, and finally, after about a month, he said, are you going to sue me? And I said, no, I really just want a job. And he said, all right, come in tomorrow morning, $3.25 an hour, and you can work, you know, the day shift. So I went in, and it was definitely the best job as far as training that I had anywhere. I learned such an enormous amount. My instincts were right about the way the kitchen was run, the way the culture in the kitchen, the recipes, the way the food was handled, the creativity with which the recipes were conceived. It was all just groundbreaking, amazing experience for me. And about 3 months later, a young girl came in to apply for a job, and Jovan hired her on the spot. And I think he was thinking, wow, you know, the first one works circles around the boys, and she's half the price. I think I'll take another one. And that happened to be Susan Feniger, and that's where I met my business partner of the last 33 years. Immediately, when I met Susan, the first day in the kitchen, I think we were immediately drawn to each other, not because we were both women, but because we both had an amazingly similar work ethic and drive and passion. I think I hadn't met anybody, male or female, up until that point who had as much drive and passion to learn about cooking as I did, and Susan definitely had that much, maybe even a little more. We became pretty fast friends very quickly. At the end of every day, we'd go down and sit and maybe have a beer and look at our notebooks and talk about the recipes we'd made that day and compare notes about the last time we made it and the next time we were going to make it, what we were going to do differently and where we wanted to move in the kitchen and how we wanted to, you know, what other recipes we were hoping to learn and to make. And when the chef finally went on vacation about a year later, he put the two of us in charge, and we would go in probably like at 5 in the morning when we were expected in at 8, and we would just get there early and, you know, clean out the walk-in and get everything ready for the day. And it was just, you know, a pretty amazing, transformative job for both of us.
Like Alice Waters and many other great culinary leaders of the food revolution, Susan set out to explore France in order to refine her culinary skills and broaden her horizons. It was there that her and Susan would start thinking about working for themselves and opening up their own place.
Neither of us felt ready to open our own restaurant, but we both kind of felt ready to take on another learning experience that was as serious, if we could find one. Susan decided to move to California and pursue some of the kind of jobs that we were starting to hear about in California. You know, we were hearing about Alice Waters, hearing about Mommy's Own and a guy named Wolf. And she decided she was going to move to California and check out what was going on. And I, in the meantime, was offered a job with my friends who owned a bakery to be the head chef of a small cafe that they were opening. So it was kind of attractive, and I thought that would be a great experience, and I'd like to, you know, try it. And so we both went off to do those things and spent about a year. Susan got a job working at Mommy's Own for Wolfgang Puck, and I opened this restaurant, this cafe on the north side of Chicago with my friends who owned the bakery. And after about a year, I felt restless again, and I decided, well, the guys who owned the bakery, one of them was my boyfriend, so we broke up, and I decided I had to move at least 2,500 miles away. So I went back and talked to Jovan at Le Perroquet and asked him if he could help me get a job in France. And he said, well, coincidentally, he was going to be leaving for France in a couple of weeks, and I could tag along. And, you know, he introduced me to some of his friends in Paris. So that's exactly what I did. I sold everything, packed up my one suitcase, and I moved to Paris without a job, and I didn't speak a word of French. But when I landed, I actually had been in touch with Susan, and as it turned out, she was going to be moving to the south of France to work at L'Oasis, a three-star restaurant. And during that year abroad, she worked there, and I was able to land a job in Paris working for a fantastic woman named Dominique Namias at a restaurant called Restaurant d'Olympe, and it was a two-star restaurant. So I think, you know, that was sort of the final apprenticeship that really gave me a lot of confidence, and I loved living in France. I loved learning the French kitchen and being around people who were as obsessed with food as I was. By the end of that first year in Paris, I felt like I was starting to feel confident and ready to make my own kind of mark and open my own restaurant. Susan, when the season ended down in the Riviera, she came to Paris and spent a couple months hanging out at my apartment, and that's when we kind of really cemented our friendship and decided that we would someday go into business together and open our restaurant together, because we were just still, you know, 3 or 4 years later, very much of the same kind of mindset and the same drive and the same passion and the same work ethic, even though neither of us had any money and we really didn't know the first thing about opening a business or running a business or owning a restaurant. I think from pretty early on, because I was a woman in a man's field, I must have gotten, you know, had the intuition that working for myself was going to be my best option. And that seemed like just a foregone conclusion. I for some reason, it never came up for me to really think about, well, who am I going to work for next? Who am I going to work for next? It was more like, when am I going to work for myself and call my own shots and be my own boss? And so that was sort of a decision that we made and decided based on just kind of pure drive, but not anything in reality. We wouldn't have known how to write a business plan, or I'd never seen a P&L from a restaurant. I really just knew that was what I was going to do. I came back to Chicago and got a job, you know, within 48 hours and just got back to work with the idea in the back of my mind that, you know, I wanted to start creating some kind of situation where I was going to be my own boss. And it turned out that Susan went back to L.A., and she called about 4 or 5 months later and said, I have an opportunity. I think you should come out. I'm working at this little cafe. They don't know what they're doing. They would love for us to do the food, and, you know, we could eventually become partners. And I said, well, I'll come out and look at the kitchen, and, you know, my birthday's next weekend. So I bought a ticket, round-trip ticket to L.A., and I went to check everything out, and there was this tiny cafe, 900 square feet, called City Cafe, and the kitchen was about 10 feet by 10 feet, and it didn't have a stove. It just had two hot plates. And I looked at Susan, and I said, you know, 2 years of chef school and all these apprenticeships, working my fingers to the bone on, you think I'm going to move out here and work without even a stove? That's crazy. But she said, no, I think we're going to put a stove in. That's the plan. We're going to put one in. We'll get one in by the time you move here. Just move here. She's very persistent. Susan is, she just doesn't take no for an answer. So sure enough, about 3 months later, I moved out. And on the weekend, I moved out. The stove was installed in the hood. And we had 4 whole burners and an oven. And we just cooked our hearts out for the first 3 years and worked 6 days and 6 nights. We were closed on Mondays, and just, you know, wrote the menu every day on a blackboard, and we served food that we just was that we grew up with, that we loved, that we learned at the different French restaurants we worked at, and eventually we started serving food that we were drawn to, that was kind of, you know, from all over the world, really. We didn't have really a certain affinity for only European food. Susan took a trip to India and came back, and we put 3 or 4 Indian dishes on the menu. And then about a year later, I took a trip to Bangkok, where my uncle was opening a gelatin capsule plant as a consultant. And he was able to get me a job working in a kitchen in Bangkok. And this was in 1983. And I worked for a month for a chef who did the authentic Thai buffet every day, and she had worked for the king and queen of Thailand. And though she didn't speak any English and I didn't speak any Thai, we just had, you know, an amazing, lovely month together, and she taught me so many great things about Thai food. I completely fell in love with it, and when I came back, we put 3 or 4 Thai dishes on the menu. So the City Cafe menu started just evolving into a real melting pot of global cuisine. And then we were starting to get a lot of recognition. Julia Child had come in. Ruth Reichel had written some really nice articles about us. And it was a great time to be a young woman chef in 1981, 82, 83, 84. That was the time when lots of explosive kind of food scene was brewing in Los Angeles. And it was just, you know, an amazing, lucky time to be in the right place.
City Cafe wasn't just another restaurant. With a menu globally inspired and Mary Sue and Susan making a name for themselves in the city of Los Angeles, they would soon move to a bigger space to open City Restaurant, which was a lesson in business and growth for them both.
We learned about a little bit about business. And we were bursting at the seams. We had not only put in the stove, we'd put in some other prep spaces in the back. We were kind of just bursting into the alley and cooking on picnic tables some of the time because we were very busy, and we needed, you know, more refrigeration and more space. It became pretty clear after 2.5-3 years that we had an opportunity to open a bigger restaurant that could really showcase our skills in a way that, you know, was different. So together with the partner who owned the cafe originally, we put out an offering and raised the money to open City Restaurant, which was about 10 blocks away. And it was in an old carpet warehouse that we'd been driving by to and from work every day and had big bow truss ceilings and very open and warehouse and like a clean slate, where we went in and talked to the carpet warehouse, the two brothers who'd gone into, followed their father into that business, and they owned the building, and we kind of badgered them until they decided that it would be a fine idea to lease the space to us for a restaurant. So we raised the money, and we were lucky enough that we had, between friends and family and some really great customers, enough people that believed in us to, you know, raise the money and open City Restaurant, which was opened in 1985 in September. So, and that was a real learning experience. I'd never opened a restaurant before for anyone I'd worked for. I'd worked for a restaurant that was up and running. And, you know, it was a different time and era, because there weren't restaurants opening and closing all the time like they are now. It was, you know, restaurants would be open and they'd run for a long, long time. And you might go and work for them, but working through an opening was something I'd never done. And so this was, and Susan hadn't done it either, so this was really learning by fire.
Mary Sue's legacy goes beyond the kitchen. In collaboration with Susan Feniger and others, she's published 5 cookbooks: City Cuisine, Mesa Mexicana, Cantina, The Best of Casual Mexican Cooking, Cooking with Two Hot Tamales, and Mexican Cooking for Dummies. She's also a seasoned television personality, starring with Feniger in 396 episodes of Two Hot Tamales and Tamales World Tour on the Food Network. Prior to the shows on the Food Network, in 1993, Milliken and Feniger appeared with Julia Child in her PBS series Cooking with Master Chefs. She's also hosted radio shows and has become known not only as a chef, but a teacher and advocate.
Susan and I both love to teach, and we started very early on, even when we just had City Cafe. And in 1982, I think we taught our first cooking class at the little cooking school that was next to Mommy's Own called Ma Cuisine. And I remember the first class, we had 7 people in the audience, and I was so nervous. I asked Susan to introduce me as her deaf-mute partner. But, of course, I did end up talking. But I think teaching is a way to really articulate what you believe in, no matter what subject you're teaching. But I really highly recommend teaching as a way to really kind of solidify your thoughts about and your philosophy and how you feel about your craft, no matter what it is. And for me, teaching really led to, first we had a radio show, which I became very interested in food safety and our food systems. Right around the time we opened Border Grill, actually, I was pregnant with my first baby, and I started to really pay a more acute attention to where our food's coming from, and I started to really ask more questions and follow news stories. And there was a big news story about ALAR on apples, and I remember Meryl Streep made a big protest about, we didn't want apples with ALAR, we wanted pure, fresh apples. And I called the radio station locally, and I said, you know, the NPR station, I'd like to do a little food minute, like an interstitial every once in a while about, you know, things that people need to be aware of that are in the food system that aren't good for you. The general manager of the radio station said, well, I think that's a terrible idea, for one. You don't want to be alarmist about the food, you know, the food system. But why don't you come in and do, like, a full one-hour radio show celebrating food? Because you guys would be great. And we'd had no experience whatsoever, had never been on a radio other than maybe a couple interviews. And within a week, there we were with our own radio show, rattling on about food for an hour every Saturday morning. After we did the radio show for 2 or 3 years, we were on a book tour with our second cookbook, Mesa Mexicana, and the publisher had sent us to the Food Network to promote the book. We did, you know, a segment on In Food Today, or one of those news shows with Donna Hanover and David Rosengarten, I think. And after we finished talking about the book, the Reese Schoenfeld, who had started the Food Network, came to us and said, you know, we think you two should have a TV show, and we should call it something like Cooking with Girls South of the Border. And Susan and I said, well, maybe we do a TV show, but it's not going to be called that. And that's when we started brainstorming what would we do a show about and what would it be called. And we had just put out our cookbook, Mesa Mexicana, and we, I think Susan's mother came up with Cooking with Two Hot Tamales as a great name for a TV show. And it kind of stuck, and Food Network liked it, and we liked it, and we went on to do about 290 shows with them.
Mary Sue is on the national board of Share Our Strength, committed to ending childhood hunger in America by 2015 with the No Kid Hungry campaign. She's passionate about the environment and leads the culinary industry with eco-friendly policies. On top of that, along with a handful of progressive women chefs, Mary Sue founded Women Chefs and Restaurateurs.
There were quite a few women chefs in San Francisco, a few less so in L.A., and a handful in New York. And we would be put together at different events when people couldn't think of a theme. They would go with, oh, let's do all the girls. Let's have all the women come and cook for this fundraiser or that event. So we would get together often when people asked us to cook at their events. And Barbara Tropp, in particular, was the founder and driver of Women Chefs and Restaurateurs. And when she invited me to be one of the founders, I at first said I didn't think I would be very good at it because I wasn't sure we needed an organization to support women. Weren't we making headway and weren't we doing pretty well on our own? And she pulled me aside and really helped me see. I think even up until that point, I was still, you know, you put your blinders on and you kind of power through certain adversities, and that's the best way to get there. And she really helped me to kind of take those blinders off and have a closer look at how women were really getting stuck and taken advantage of and not really moving forward in the culinary field as they should or could have. So it was a great experience for me to be part of the founding board of the Women Chefs and Restaurateurs, a very powerful group of women, Lydia Bastianich and Barbara Tropp and Joyce Goldstein and Barbara Lazaroff and Anne Rosenzweig, Joanne Killeen from Rhode Island. We got together several times, and it was a great, great experience for me to learn from other women what some of their challenges were and where we could really support the up-and-coming women in our field. What success looks like for me 20 years from now would be to have grown my company and have, instead of 350 employees, maybe have 700 or 800 or maybe 1,000 employees, and I think I'm very proud of employing people. I think that is one of the things that gets me up in the morning and makes me happy about my job. I also would like for my role in the company to shift so that I can be more less every single day and more focused on these extracurricular things that I love to do. And hopefully, you know, people will look to Border Grill as a not a super expensive, a very affordable restaurant that took on some of these challenges of serving the right kind of meats, the right kind of fish, the right kind of vegetables, and in the right combination so that you know, we have an 80-20 program where we're serving dishes that are 80% plant-based with just 20% protein. And we try to create as many of those kinds of dishes as we can. And I'd like to be known as a leader of a movement that, you know, gets our food system to the places that it's going to need to go to feed almost 8 billion people.
Evolutionaries is produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The songs used in this piece in order of appearance are Blue Light by Jack Inslee, Look at Me When You Lick the Dutch by Rectech, Mild 7 by End Vice Versa, Snickers by Obesity, Hallways by Knife Show, All Night by Morph Ground, Magic 13 by RDBN, Island by AGT, 4 of 7 by Jack Inslee, Dirty Hands by Eula, and again Blue Light by Jack Inslee.
Next is the 21st century godmother of Italian food, Lidia Bastianich. A culinary powerhouse, she oversees an empire that spans television shows, cookbooks, restaurants, and countless appearances. Learn how she was able to meld the personal and professional while sticking to her roots and passions, specifically food and family.
You know, sometimes I encounter people and they come up to me in the street and they say, Lidia, can I hug you? And I said, yeah, and I love that. Food is quite touchable, and basically I become quite touchable.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org proudly presents Evolutionaries, Lidia Bastianich. Lidia Bastianich has two passions, family and food, and she's managed to create a culinary empire using both. Lidia is the chef owner of four acclaimed New York City restaurants, Thalidia, Becco, Esca, and Del Posto, as well as Lidia's in Pittsburgh and Kansas City. She's the author of over 10 cookbooks and has hosted more than four television shows on PBS.
I was kind of blessed in a simple way, and that is family. My support was the family. We came here as immigrants. I was 12 years old, my brother, my mother, and my father. Now, I kind of have to explain why we came as immigrants. I was born in Istria. Istria is a little peninsula that is now part of Croatia. But it was Italy. And after World War II, and Italy was on the losing side, when the territories were divided, Istria was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia. We got caught behind it, behind the Iron Curtain. I was just born at that time, just the end of the war. And we were in communist sort of regime for 10 years until my parents decided that we needed to go back to Italy. They needed to get us kids back to a normal life, you know, where we could speak Italian, go to church, and do all the normal things. And my brother, my mother, and I went to visit some aunt that were left in Italy. My father ultimately escaped. We came to Trieste. We had family, difficult living with the family also because jobs were hard to get. And finally, my parents decided to go to refugee camp. We ended up in a political refugee camp, San Saba. And we lived there for 2 years in the camp, awaiting a visa to come to the States or to Australia or to Canada. Those were the options, what my parents were looking for. And we were one of the first family to be brought here. We were brought in the United States in 1958. We were brought here by the Catholic Charities, so we had nobody here either. We came here and we slowly began our life as Americans. But I was 12, my brother was 16. Us kids really got into it. So, you know, I feel very American and I feel very Italian. My passion for food is Italian. You know, those 10 years in communist Yugoslavia, I was put with my grandmother. My mother was a school teacher, and therefore she worked in the city. But my grandmother would take me to church. Nobody knew that I, you know, me and my brother, and we would speak Italian. But what was beautiful about that setting was that she had this magical courtyard with all the courtyard animals. We had ducks, we had geese, we had chickens, we had goats, we had pigs. And all of that, and the garden, you know, the seasonal garden, everything from wheat to potatoes to corn to, we made our own flour, our own olive oil. And so I grew up in that really connected setting, connected to food. I mean, you know, we would milk the goat. I would drink a warm goat's milk, make the cheese from the goat cheese, the ricotta, the fresh ricotta from and all of that. So my recall memories of food goes back to there. So I think that that's my kind of reference library for food, that kind of honesty, and I still cook in that fashion, in that philosophy. And then coming to the States, you know, I made, United States is my home now, and I, you know, I feel very connected. I did not speak English at all. You know, once we were in the camp awaiting, they had an opportunity, a class that you could go, and we did, but I did not speak the language. So I must say, for my brother and myself, it was very exciting, the discovery. So when we came here, we says, okay, finally, we can make this. We can put maybe our roots here. Maybe we can, this is our home. We're not going anywhere from here. And I think it was the excitement of having finally that kind of reached that destination that we could make our own. And, you know, at 12 and at 16, the world is your oyster. I mean, you're there, you're ready. And I had all positive memories of discovering America, learning English. Within a year, my brother and I spoke English. My parents had a more difficult time in adjusting. And as children, you realize that, and you kind of try to sort of helped and settle them. And that's why I maybe began working very early at 14 in the bakery right across where we lived, and then in restaurants when I went to school, you know, like kids do today, more or less. But I found that food was my venue. My mother used to work late. I used to make dinners for the family. She would kind of set it all up for me. She said, soak the beans, change the water, put it in half an hour, put the potatoes. So in her own way, she would give me instructions and recipes at that age.
Lydia came to the United States from Istria when she was 12 years old with her parents and her brother Franco. She had wanted to become a doctor, but fate had other plans for her.
I wanted to be a pediatrician, and I remember there was a ship of hope that would go around Africa and whatever, and the doctors would go and help the children. And that's what I thought I was going to be. And maybe that's because so many people helped us along the way getting that was, you know, the feeling that I want. Then, you know, things happen. But I did in college, you know, I went on through the sciences and all that. So I was kind of, but food really took over once I met my husband, who was in the food industry. And I guess that was my destiny. I ultimately got into the food line. But food is also a great way of, you know, given to people, giving back. There's so many opportunities that we as chefs, as everybody has, to give back the basics, the food.
When Lydia was 24 years old, she opened her first restaurant, Bonavia, in Queens. The success of Bonavia led to the opening of a second restaurant in Queens, Villa Secondo. It was here that Bastianich gained the attention of local food critics and started to give live cooking demonstrations, a prelude to her future career as a television cooking show hostess.
It was all about the family. So my two children were born. My mother lived with us. She's 93. She still lives with me. And I would work, and she would take them home, put them to bed. And so this kind of caring, I was, you know, really family and nurturing, just maybe like I remember back home with grandma. But Joe and Tanya were always at the restaurant, in a sense. They would get their meal there. Grandma would come, then she would take them home. And, you know, because I had to work and, you know, I wanted to be with them as well. So they really got to be in the restaurant. They used to do their homework in the restaurant. But I always used to tell them, this is not what you're going to do. This is, you're in America, you get your education and get a real American job. And so they did. You know, Joe, his master's business, went to Wall Street. Tanya, ultimately her PhD in Renaissance art history from Oxford, went a professor and so on. They both work with me. So what happened, I think, along the way is, and I'm so blessed, is that they realized how important this culture is and maybe how much fun and how much, you know, it kept the family together, this business did. And so they slowly followed into the business in their own right. You know, Joe with all the restaurants and the shows. Tanya is being the academic type, does all the research, co-authors the cookbooks with me, directs my production company. But now I have grandchildren, so grandchildren are all mine.
In 1981, the Bastianich family purchased a small Manhattan brownstone containing a pre-existing restaurant on the east side of Manhattan. That brownstone would become Thalidia, their flagship restaurant, which quickly garnered rave reviews, including 3 stars from the New York Times. Lydia didn't stop there. With the help of her family, she went on to expand the business, opening 3 more restaurants in New York and additional restaurants in Pittsburgh and Kansas City.
Here I am, I have Felidia, and it's glorious. I have a grand time. I'm getting a lot of awareness and opportunities, and then my son Joseph decides that he's going to leave Wall Street, and again, this is what he's going to do, and, you know, all right. And so we move on to the next stage, which ultimately was wonderful. But once he got in, you know, he was American. He's American born. He's young, educated here. And he said, Mom, you know, we opened, we had Felidia. And of course, then we opened Becco on West 46th Street about a year and something after. And that was his business involvement, you know, encouraging him to do what he wanted to do and what he knew best. We found the space, we got the concept, big success. And after that, he says, "Why? You know, there's a whole big America here. We shouldn't just stay in New York. And let's go in middle of America. Let's go in the Midwest." So we went, we visited Ohio, we went to Kansas, ultimately found this place. We actually, a young man who was from Kansas City and worked for Banffy, actually, Banffy Winery in New York here. He says, you know, I want to go back home, and I think that Kansas City would be the perfect. And ultimately, we went there. We researched. Why right across the railroad tracks? I think that was so Midwestern, you know. It was perfect. It was an abandoned brewery. And I felt that, you know, the whole neighborhood was kind of a little bit abandoned, but I felt challenging. I said, this, you know, this could be beautiful. Look at the trains coming and going. It really exemplifies America. And that's how we landed there, and we're still there, and it's a great place to be. The whole neighborhood is so revived now, and we actually got the key to the city for being one of the catalysts for the revival of that neighborhood. I was married 27 years before we separated. And the idea was that he just wanted to call it quits. He wanted to go and retire, go back to Italy. And I was just in the midst of I loved what I did. There was no way that I was going to. So it's you know, I guess traditional is the usual way where the two roads kind of go in different directions. You know, I didn't want to impose on him what I wanted to do, and neither did I want him to impose on me or limit me in any way. And we remained friends. I mean, he passed away since, but, you know, we would have all the holidays and everything with the kids. So our relationship really remained the kids by then were married. I made sure that they had their own family so that they wouldn't be. So it was kind of almost a natural split that gave him the opportunity to do what he wanted and gave me an opportunity to do what I wanted.
In 2010, Lydia Bastianich continued growing her business, and along with her son Joe, she partnered with Oscar Farinetti and Mario Batali to open Eataly, a 50,000-square-foot food emporium in Manhattan that is devoted to the food and culinary traditions of Italy. Eataly's motto is, "We sell what we cook, and we cook what we sell."
As I said, you know, I transported the true Italian culinary culture that I knew that I was part of to my new adopted home, America. And I did it in a most genuine way, you know, like you would somebody bring it in your home and say, this is my home, this is what I do. What happened is that, you know, I got involved in a sense of really understanding the evolution of Italian cuisine in America and ultimately seeing how, you know, what I was doing was making a difference. Now, you know, I this message that came out of my passion, my communication. So it didn't have the you know, the ultimate goal, okay, I'm going to promote all of Italy. But it ultimately did. You know, there's certainly so many more people that are doing the same, but I guess through my restaurants, through my visibility, through my books, my television. Now the spread of our restaurants and the partnership with Italy, which is, you know, it's this big marketplace, if you will, that really exemplifies Italian style, the best that Italy has to offer in every 360 degrees from raw food to prepared food to restaurants to, you know, between doing television in Italy even, now somehow, you know, it's more evident that what I did and what I do has a lot of resonance out there in the world, especially in America, in bringing Italy and Italian products and Italian food forth. You know, I always hold it very important that I do justice, that I, you know, research correctly and then I bring it forth correctly. If that has some financial benefits to somebody, you know, that's great because it keeps the Italians working and it keeps the American understanding ever better the good flavor of the Italian cuisine. But my message is always the culture, the real culture of Italy. I look for a sparkle in a young person's eye, the enthusiasm and passion when they speak about food, but it could be in any way. I can see it, you know, writing about food, photography of food. When I see that sparkle and that desire, then I want to put my hands on, I want to be there for that person. And whatever I can do to lead them, to lead that energy, it's, you know, it's almost like physics. If you have inertia, you know, for me to energize inertia, but if I have energy, if there's a ball moving there, I'm going to kind of push it around in the direction that I want. So I think the most exciting thing for me is when I do see these young, enthusiastic individuals that, you know, certainly have accomplished already so much or that are just getting there. And if I could be instrumental in any way, you know, and we look for those a lot in our companies and the why did we grow so much and how could have we grown so much? And it's precisely because of those talented individuals that we were able, maybe that came to us also because they kind of, you know, one energy pulls the other and together. These energies, these newfound energies, allow us to grow as a company and allow them to grow as themselves within the company, with us, or move on and do their own things. The young people, and, you know, I am so excited by the enthusiasm of the young people in getting involved in food-related businesses, jobs, whether it's writing or television or photography. Food offers so many different aspects of you know, making a profession out of it. The one thing that I can say, and, you know, I can talk about the food preparation and my industry, the restaurant industry and so on, is that you need to be prepared as a human being. Therefore, I always recommend that young people do their education into college to enrich themselves, whether they love music or something. Just enrich yourself in what your curiosity is. In the meantime, keep your hands dirty if that's what you like, if cooking. Get opportunities to work, to do, to stay people close to people that whose work you appreciate and admire. Then, of course, you need the actual training in the field, you know, the go to a cooking school of some sort for the basics, and then travel. Travel, experience other cultures, experience the world, experience food in the raw. Just get an understanding what the cycle of food really is from the earth up. And along the way, you know, if you admire somebody or you know, in a sense, a mentor, find them, spend time, make sure that you get close to them and that you take from them what you admire from them. And usually these people are very receptive and you have to, you know, make it your business. So you have to accumulate. You have to make this great library of resources within yourself, collect all of these experiences. And this takes years. You know, I mean, sometimes I interview people young from school, you know, and just like you said, in as a mentor, give them a sense of what they should be doing. And, you know, and I ask them, well, where do you want to come with your life? Where do you want to end with your life? And these are people, you know, 20, 22, 24. I want to be like you. I said, okay, 40 years and a lot of hard work.
This piece was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The songs used in this piece are Prospect Dub by Archipelago, Carried Away by The Hollows, Make It Right by Comanche, Grey Goose by Tom Cruise, Bike It in Dreams by Taxstar, Ancestors by Peels, and yet again Prospect Dub by Archipelago.
Finally, from New York City, we head north to Boston, where Chef Lydia Shire's story unfolds. Listen to how a hometown girl reached culinary heights and went on to win a James Beard Award for Best Chef Northeast and the Women Chefs and Restaurateurs 2011 Golden Whisk Award.
When I do die, I'm going to be thrown overboard so the lobsters can eat me, because I've killed so many lobsters in my life. And since I'm growing my own fatty liver, I think the lobsters would like me.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org presents Evolutionaries, Lydia Shire. Lydia Shire is the enduring culinary talent behind some of Boston's most celebrated restaurants. She's universally acclaimed, having won a James Beard Award for Best Chef Northeast and the Women Chefs and Restaurateurs 2011 Golden Whisk Award. She's known for her use of fat and offal and her exuberant personality in the kitchen. Lydia grew up in Brookline, Massachusetts, and fell in love with food at a young age.
Both my parents were fashion illustrators and artists. My father was a great cook. You know, he was Irish, and you know what they say about the Irish, they're not the best cooks, but there's always exceptions to the rule. And he would cut out recipes from the New York Times, and, you know, I'd come home from school, and when he would get home, all of a sudden these beautiful smells would be coming from the kitchen. You know, he would cook chicken legs with sherry and mushrooms, and there's nothing like the smell of sherry that goes through your house, you know, with chicken cooking. And all my friends always wanted to have dinner at my house, you know, so I grew up in Brookline, right in Coolidge Corner, so we always had a ton of people over for dinner. You know, at 4 years old and five, I was chopping fresh garlic for spaghetti alle olli with my father's cleaver. And he didn't have a French chef knife, so he exposed me to it very early, and I just kind of, that's what I love.
Lydia's first professional cooking position was garde-manger at Maison Robert. She landed the job in a very creative way.
What I did was I made a 9-layer cake, very thin layers with French buttercream. Raymond Oliver's cake in one of his books, and I took it on my job interview. And, you know, that was kind of unusual back then. I mean, people don't usually show up at an interview with, you know, a cake. And I had to order an air-conditioned cab because of the buttercream, because it was a sweltering day in July when I went for this interview. And I think they were just basically impressed that I went to that trouble. And that is sort of a lesson in life, isn't it? Because if you want something badly, you have to set yourself apart. So I got the job, and, you know, but they stuck me in garde-manger, and, you know, I wasn't crazy about that. I wanted to cook.
Lydia left Maison Robert to attend culinary school in London in 1971, which sparked her love affair with Euro cuisine, cream, butter, fat, salt, and most importantly, meat. Upon coming home, she returned to Maison Robert, this time becoming head chef.
I went back to Maison Robert. You know, they started me right at the bottom. I was on the grill, and then I moved to sauté, and then I went upstairs to the fancy dining room. Then I became the chef up there, and that was back in the 70s. There were, I would say, probably no other women chefs who were entrusted with a French dining room. But, you know, I've always worked really hard, and time means nothing to me. I would get there early in the morning and stay late at night, and, you know, it was just what I had to do. I remember when I worked at Maison Robert, Lucien Robert was the owner, and he used to go down to the meat market and buy these beautiful whole lamb, baby lamb. And, you know, they were from New England. And that was, I mean, some people could say that was the dark ages of cooking in America, but he was filling his Saab with carcasses of lamb. In the summer, his wife, Anne Robert, would bring home choke cherries from Minnesota, and we would make homemade choke cherry sorbet, which is the best sorbet I've ever had in my whole life. And, you know, we were doing seasonal foods back then. I think the difference is we didn't have the writers who are writing about it. You know, there wasn't quite as much interest for the average American about what was really going on in restaurants. So, you know, that's changed a lot.
While working as head chef at Maison Robert, Lydia was introduced to Julia Child, who frequently ate at the restaurant. The two went on to form a friendship that would end up landing Lydia her next job as chef at Harvest Restaurant in Cambridge.
Julia did one thing that you should know about, and I think that this was probably her most beautiful attribute. I mean, obviously we know she was a great cook and a great writer, but she loved getting people together. And I'll never forget, I had a phone call from her one day. I was at Maison Robert, and she said, "Lydia, would you come over for lunch tomorrow?" Of course, you don't say no to Julia. So I did, and I walked up to her back pathway to her kitchen door at her house in Cambridge, and I could smell the most beautiful smell coming from the kitchen. She had made a Roquefort Jalousie tart with puff pastry, so all I could smell was this butter and this Roquefort cheese coming out of that back door, and it was just amazing. And when I walked up to the door and knocked and she let me in, her husband Paul was there, and another young girl was there. And this young girl was thinking about becoming a cook. So Julia had this lunch just to introduce me to this young girl. And, you know, Julia so often would open her home to get people together to meet each other. So that was such the unselfish part of Julia, where she just wanted to be a conduit for people. It wasn't about herself. It wasn't her glorifying herself. She just wasn't like that. And I went to visit her in Place Cassière, her home in France, and she asked me to make a help her with a leg of lamb and make the sauce. And I remember my knees were shaking. And in fact, that day when she made the Roquefort Jalousie tart, she asked me to make a dressing for her salad. And again, my knees were shaking because, you know, you were in front of Julia Child. I was offered a job. You know, that was the job that Julia got for me at the Harvest Restaurant in Cambridge. And it was my first full-fledged chef job, you know, where I did everything. I did all the ordering, hiring, writing the menus, cooking on the line. The buck stopped with me for that job. And I would say I failed in that job. You know, I was there for 9 months, and I really don't think I did a very good job. I did a great job cooking, but I did not do a good job managing, and that taught me a lesson. When I left there, I knew I had to change my ways and take on a much stronger role in working with people. Because at the end of the day, cooking is the fun part of our job, but managing people is difficult at times. After the Harvest, I went to the Copley Plaza Hotel, and I was the chef of the fancy dining room there, Cafe Plaza. And Alan Tremaine, the owner of the hotel, had me go down to Rhode Island and open La Pogée at the Biltmore in Rhode Island. So I did, and I was the chef there of the fancy dining room. And Jasper walked in one day from California, and he was hired as a night chef. So he wasn't happy there, and I actually sent him, and he took my old job at the Cafe Plaza. I'm a little older than Jasper, but we became just best friends. And, you know, he went on and opened his own restaurant. We opened the Bostonian Hotel together, and that was very special. You know, that was an all-American wine list and really all-American food. That was really a great time in my life. You know, when you think of hotels, you know, if you blink your eyes and think back to the 80s, 70s, late 70s, you always kind of could imagine a French restaurant being the headline restaurant in a hotel. And Frank Fisher and Richard Palmer, who were running the Bostonian Hotel, which is right in the middle of Boston, it's right in Faneuil Hall, they wanted something different, and they wanted a new approach. And Richard Palmer, who was from England, said, "No, I'm having an all-American wine list." And I even thought he was crazy because I'm such a lover of Burgundies. But, you know, he did, and we got rave reviews for it, and we headed the food in the same direction. It wasn't so much to cook a Dover sole with Meunier and something French with it, but we wanted to showcase American food. So we had Johnny Cakes on the menu with crab and things that were definitely more New England. The Four Seasons hired me to open the Four Seasons Hotel in Beverly Hills. And I was the first woman to open a hotel in the Four Seasons group. That was very exciting. That was a great time in my life. I took two other chefs with me, both women. Susan Regis, who worked for me ultimately for 19 years, and Leslie Mackey, who's a great baker and pastry chef up in Seattle. And the first month we were open at the Four Seasons, we did almost $250,000 in banquet business only. That's not even the restaurant. And I was sleeping 2 hours a night, getting up at 4 a.m. I'd go and pick up Susan and Leslie, and I finally totaled my car one night because I just fell asleep, you know, behind the wheel. But it was a great time. It was very exciting to be out there. I remember Joan Collins was sitting on the other side of the kitchen right there eating away, and it was fun. I did clash with the general manager at the time, Mr. Ferraro. He wanted the banquets to be French served, and you know what that means. The waiter comes over with a tray of 10 veal chops, and another waiter comes with a platter of green beans, and you drop the veal chop down and the green beans. And I said, no. I said, I want the cooks in the kitchen to plate the food because it's way more beautiful. What we can do on a plate and then send it out is way, way more beautiful. And interestingly, after I left, they're still doing it my way.
In 1989, Lydia returned to Boston and opened Biba, which fittingly stood for Back in Boston Again. She pushed the limits of acceptability for Boston diners at Biba and found great success, taking home the James Beard Award for Best Chef Northeast in 1992.
When I opened Biba, the downstairs was a bar, and I wanted a bar food menu. And I love scallion pancakes, and there was one restaurant, a real dive, a hole in the wall in Boston, in Chinatown. And this man was from the north, where, of course, the scallion pancakes are a northern, more Mandarin dish. And he was from the north. He was actually in the army. He was a kind of an older chef at the time. And my Chinese girlfriend asked him if he would teach me the recipe, and he said, sure, come over on my one day off, which was whatever, Wednesday, I can't remember. And I knocked on the door at 12:30, the time that I was supposed to be there, and my friend, my Chinese friend, had not shown up yet. So he opened the door and I went in, and we can't speak because he can't speak English. And so, you know, I'm just looking at him and smiling, and all of a sudden he grabs me and he starts feeling me up. And I said to myself, well, wait a minute, Lydia. What do you want more? Do you want the scallion pancake recipe, or do you mind if he has a couple of cheap feels? So I said, I think I'm going to live with the cheap feels. It was a great space. It was overlooking the public gardens in Boston, so it was literally front and center. I mean, you could look out our front windows and see the Ritz-Carlton across the way, and the Four Seasons Hotel was right next to me. So we were in the best spot. And I interviewed 6 architects and decided on Adam Tahani. And to this day, I think there's no greater an architect than Adam Tahani, and he had another architect working with him, Rafael Alvarez, who actually designed Scampo, my restaurant I have right now. So you kind of stick with the best when you find them. And it was just a big, fun place. It was 7,600 square feet. You know, we had 200 people that could sit upstairs and 51 downstairs in the bar. I had 2 bars. I always wanted a little bar for single travelers to be able to sit where they wouldn't feel strange. And that was upstairs. And that was right across from our wood-burning oven. On the menu, I had a whole offal section, O-F-F-A-L. And, you know, again, I thought that Boston is such a gateway and we have so many travelers who probably want a piece of calf's liver or calf's brains, and you know, where would they get them in Boston? So we became known for that. And I think pretty much I was the first chef of that nature to have a whole offal section on the menu. So that was back in 1989 when we opened. Biba, after 13 and a half years, needed a redo, like most restaurants. And so I took on 2 partners, Tim Lynch from Grill 23 in Boston, a very famous steakhouse in Boston, and Ken Hemmel. And we morphed Biba into Excelsior, and we sunk a lot of money into it. We built a beautiful glass wine tower in the restaurant. And, you know, it was gorgeous, really gorgeous. And Adam Tahani did it again. And then my relationship with Ken Hemmel fell apart. It is what it is, and we all moved on. And I was very involved with Lockober, which was my restaurant for 10 years. The owner of the property that Lockober was sitting in, that was it. Our lease was over.
After Biba fell apart, Lydia went on to open other restaurants, including Blue Sky in York Beach and the award-winning Scampo, where she still cooks today. She's also the culinary director for Town Stove and Spirits. Lydia is famous for her love of fat, and she isn't shy about it.
You know, I'm definitely a carnivore. You know, we don't cut any fat off, you know, and fat is key. We buy the most amazing pork from Heritage Foods USA. It's the best I've ever had in my life. And, you know, we cook it with skin on, you know, the pork rack. He just sent me one the other day for a very VIP party I was cooking for. And these pigs that he has are raised, you know, for their tenderness and their flavor and the fat content. And I think it's shocking the amount of, I call it abuse, that butchers now in America and supermarkets, what they're doing to meat. They're just ripping all the fat off. You can't even cook it. It's not good. You know, I believe you have to have, obviously, a balanced diet, and I don't suggest you have fat at every meal, but, you know, there are times when you just need fat.
Lydia sees Boston as a culinary community unto its own and is proud to represent the often overlooked city.
I think the best cook in Boston when I was growing up was definitely Monsef Medeb. He was the originator of L'Espalier in Boston. And he just was one amazing cook. I was working at the Copley Plaza then, and I just called him up one night, and I invited him over to have a drink with me at the end of the night. And he came over, and I really had never met him before. And And we sat down and talked. He was from Northern Africa. And just an amazing cook. Once again, there's that beauty of Boston. You know, we're little. You could just be spontaneous with another chef, and it worked. I would like to be remembered as a colorful person. You see, I have my red scarf on today, my red pocketbook. I would like to be remembered as somebody who, number one, whose big mission in life was top quality. No question about it. I mean, that's what I strive for all the time. And I feel I've done that and I've grasped it. And I'm very proud of that.
This piece was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org, with additional research by Nathaniel Coburn. The songs used in this piece are Quick by Dane Chadwick, Leng by Andy Petter and Peter Boothroyd, One-Eyed None Such by Ball of Flame Shoot Fire, It Ain't Hard to Tell by the California Honey Drops, Nine Haiku by Eric Maltz, Feel Some Bodies by Hard Bodies, All Nighter by Morph Ground, Diamond Head by OL, No Friday by Space Ghost, Grey Goose by Tom Cruise, and again Quick by Dane Chadwick.
For full Evolutionaries episodes, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org or search for us on iTunes and Stitcher. This is Elizabeth Sachs reporting for HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.